together tonight on Nagarjuna. And then I understand you break up into groups? Is that sometimes. Not necessarily. Okay.
You can do it however you want to do it.
Okay, well.
Sometimes we just have a
Mm-hmm. I think, okay, let's play it by ear a little bit and see how it goes. And then if we want to change it for next week and the week after, we can do that. You may not want to do it next week or the week after, but I will presume that tonight will be stimulating enough that you'll want to come back. My name is David Diagon Luke, or Diagon David Luke, and it's spelled with a G-A-N and not O-N. It's continuously misspelled. Gan meaning vow. I say gan, no. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor to be here, sitting in Norman's seat, since Norman was the one who was good enough to give me the Dharma transmission. I feel honored to be in his seat tonight. I hope I do well by it. So Jeff had mentioned that you were interested in Nagarjuna. Have you studied any of Nagarjuna yet? Well, Nagarjuna, I don't know how we can consider ourselves to be Madhyamaka Buddhists without understanding the principal tenets of the Mahayana Madhyamaka or middle path, without having some rather involved association with the very subtle and very subtle teachings, and difficult often to grasp teachings of the middle way as presented by Nagarjuna. Now, the text that I have suggested by Professor Jay Garfield, I have found to be, many that I've read, his explanations are actually written not for Buddhologists, but for other philosophers, academics, mathematicians. And in consequence, he finds a way of presenting it that is, I think, accessible to most of us. In the commentary, there's no way you can read the Mula Madhyamika Karika, or the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, by yourself without somebody's commentary. Because the way this format is set up, the dialectic between Nagarjuna and the different philosophical positions that he proves are essentially contradictory between himself and his opponent is not indicated in the text itself. So when you were reading it, you wouldn't know whose position was arguing what point without a commentary. So most of you have heard of Nagarjuna, I think. I don't know if, how many of you read some of this? Well, then maybe you're way ahead of me. Anyway, we don't know much about Nagarjuna for those of you who haven't studied this, but he was born or presented his materials, we think, somewhere around the 2nd century of the Common Era. There's some interesting legends about him as being the great debater and dialectician of Nalanda University, and he was an abbot, apparently. But the legend about him, I find is interesting, is that when he was a young man and had shown great promise as a monk and as a skilled philosopher, Santradika school, he and two other of his classmates one night, apparently, according to legend, snuck into the king's seraglio with his mistresses and had themselves a ball. And when the king found out about it, he was apparently, for some reason, incensed and sent his guards. But because they were so advanced in their practice of meditation, they became invisible. The guards could follow their footsteps by putting flour on the floor, even though they were invisible, they could follow them. and swept the air with their scimitars, with their swords, and struck down Nagarjuna's two friends. But Nagarjuna stood so close to the king himself in his invisibility that he was spared, and this, according to the legend, sobered him. I find this interesting because it makes him a little bit more human and less distant and inaccessible. The other part of the legend is really interesting, is that at some point, you might know this, while he was lecturing, there were a couple of monks that would come, strangers, to hear his lectures, and there were hundreds that would come to hear him, thousands apparently. And they had a very fragrant aroma to them, the aroma of sandalwood. And so one time he singled them out afterwards, and they said, we are not really monks, we're not really humans, we are Nagas. That is to say, subterranean lakes or bodies of water, who have come up to bring you to a place of new understanding, new revelation. We're about to reveal some new teachings to you. So this theory, this legend, is based on the idea that Nagarjuna had to go down into the depths, to the depths, to get the Prajnaparamita, the teaching of shunyata, the teaching of emptiness, the teaching of no inherent self in any phenomena whatsoever. And that this was kept at the bottom of, for 1,000 years now, almost, 600 years, I guess. But yeah, about 600 years. At the bottom of this lake, until mankind or humankind was ready to actually hear the real subtleties that they now entrusted in Nagarjuna, and from which or from whom he took his name. And so it has been postulated or theorized that going into the depths, into the deeper subterranean aspects of the world, or is to go deeper into our own unconscious, subconscious understanding. There are a couple other things I'd like to say before we start. One is that the interesting thing about all of the Madhyamika teachings, or I should say the Prajnaparamita teachings, is that as you study them, that is, as you absorb the concepts or the concept designation of so-called reality, the very process in which we are programming this is the very thing they're talking about, how we do this and how we reify it. So unlike a text that points to something outside of the self, this text deconstructs. What Nagarjuna does is set up a situation and then take it all away, so that you're left with nothing to grasp except what you already have. So that the so-called ultimate and the so-called conventional are conflated into one thing. And how is that so? And this is an enormous leap in the evolution of religious thought, I believe, about how the conventional reality and the so-called ultimate reality are presented in the teachings of Nagarjuna, and particularly his later interpreters, Chandrakirti in particular, a philosopher about 300 years later, and how this text has actually come down to us through the Tibetan tradition. This text is actually from a Tibetan translation. And the Tibetan Prasadika school, the school of logical dialectical inquiry into the nature of reality, and the methodology of their practices of meditation, and how to actually not only understand the material, but through meditation practices of shamatha and vipassana, actually come to realize it in our day-to-day life. But the first aspect of the learning is one must hear it, one must hear the logic of it, one must practice the logic of it, one must see the logic of it, one must conceptualize the logic of it. It's not something that can be grasped intuitively. That at least is the prasadika and Nagarjuna's own position, as I understand it. Now, of course, these are all interpretations. this is my interpretation of what Garfield is interpreting, what Chandrakirti was interpreting of Nagarjuna, and so on. And this constant reinterpretation is a dependent co-arising event in and of itself, so that there isn't some absolute thing, some absolute identity of a teaching that has come down from Buddhist time to us unchanged by any historical or cultural processes. That would be to reify some aspect that is contrary to the teachings that we are going to study here. And then I want to just mention before we start also that Stephen Batchelor has done the translation called Verses from the Center. And if you are familiar with Stephen Batchelor, you know that he's not only, you know, extremely skilled thinker and writer, but he's, of course, also fluent in Tibetan and has Tibetan teachings, and has done a somewhat different view of the presentation that Garfield has. Then David Kamito, our own David Kamito, used to be with us, did Nagarjuna's 70 stanzas. You can still get this book. This is a little different than the Mula Madhyamika, but it presents pretty much the same material. And David's exposition at the beginning of it, and the process of the Tibetan Prasangika school's way of coming to terms with the material is really elucidating. What? These are all very, these are very helpful texts. You cross-reference them in your study, and this is something you go on the rest of your life. Nagarjuna is not something you're going to get in a couple of swallows. The Emptiness of Emptiness by Huntington is Chandrakirti's Entrance to the Middle Way, which is an interpretation of Nagarjuna, and is also, although much more technical than Batchelor and even David, is also accessible and I thought very helpful. So, any questions? Yes, they all have, all three have, in fact, all four of these books have wonderful commentaries and translations of the material themselves. And they're presented in the same kind of format in which the usually the translation comes first and then the commentary. Now tonight, next week and the following week, I think what I would like to do is start not at the beginning, but the heart of the Mula Madhyamika is actually the 25th chapter, which is, I'll tell you where to, we're going to begin a little before that, but it's with the examination of the Four Noble Truths, because it is here that Nagarjuna really gets into gear about talking the nature of how the ultimate and the conventional are conflated. But before that, I also want to read with you. Yeah, but I'm going to get to some other part first. I want to come to page, the dedicatory verses is on page 100. Let's start with page 100, and then after we go through the dedicatory, because the dedication isn't really important. In fact, when we studied this, were you with us at Tassar when we did this? Was it more? Yeah. The practice period that I did at Tassar in 1992 or 1993 or something with Reb, one of those years, we spent the practice period with just Nagarjuna and the Mula Madhyamika. And it changed my life. It changed my whole view of what Buddhism was about. Until then, it was fancy dancing around grasping some kind of faith idea, some kind of consolation or so on. I did not really, I was trying hard to grab hold of what Dogen was even talking about. It was not until we came to this particular study that what we had been working on first was to kind of present material that would substantiate, if I can use that word in Nagarjuna, substantiate some background so that we could come to this material. By studying this material, watch how it affected our own minds, and in watching that very process feed back into the reading of the material itself is very exciting, very engaging. I found. Other people found it a little perplexing. Well, I did too. But anyway, we always started with reading the dedicatory verses. And it actually sums up the whole teaching in the verse, but then we have to explicate it. And then there's one more thing. There is a poem. I looked for some poem in the English language, in the American idiom, that would also throw maybe a little light on what we're doing. And I followed one by Wallace Stevens. In fact, we used it in this. It was called Snowman. Are you familiar with that one? You know. If I can remember, it goes like this. And I use this phrase, the mind of winter. One must have a mind of winter. One must have a mind of winter to regard. In a moment. One must have a mind of winter to regard the boughs of the pine trees. One must have a mind of winter to regard the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow and have been cold a long time, to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the oaks rough in the distant glare of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the same sound blowing in the same land for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is. It brings these two things really interestingly together in that poem. So one poem that, even though I don't think Wallace Stevens was maybe conversant with Buddhist thought, anyway, I wanted to mention that. So have a mind of winter, and not think of grasping any aspect when you begin to get rattled by Nagarjuna's cold wind. So instead of doing our usual verse, let's read this one together as our opening verse tonight, rather than unsurpassed penetrating and perfect. Okay? I prostrate to the perfect Buddha, the best of teachers, who taught that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing, unborn, unannihilated, not permanent, not coming, not going, without distinction, without identity, and free from conceptual action. Tough battery. That's very interesting. PTSD. I bow to Buddha who teaches contingency. No death, no birth, no nothing, no eternity, no arrival, no departure, no identity, no difference, and ease fixations. It's a little different. It has the same feeling to it. So now let's read together, and maybe we can take turns going around. I'll start with the first paragraph. This is page 100. Yes. I just think that by talking about this verse a little bit, it's a wonderful way to ease ourselves into the chapter that we will read, because many of the things that are set forth in this reading are already going to be presented here. Dedicatory verses are often treated as mere performatives, but these are special and announce in a subtle but powerful way the program of the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. Karika means verse. There is a common point being made in the four pairwise denials, but also a specific insight being expressed in each. The relation between the conventional and the ultimate that will be developed in the text is also expressed poetically in the dedication. In fact, Chandrakirti, the Prasannanapada, argues that the dedication determines the prasannika reading of Nagarjuna's text. Chandrakirti's point is this. In the four pairwise denials, Nagarjuna is announcing that the Madhyamika philosopher will make no positive assertions about the fundamental nature of things. This is something to keep in mind from the beginning, that Nagarjuna himself, or the Madhyamika position, cannot take a position. Even the position of taking no position is whatever, anyway, from the very beginning you will see, And whatever position you take is a conventional position, and because it is dependently arisen, it is empty of the inherent existence. Therefore, he takes no particular or asserts no particular position. Nagarjuna is announcing that the philosopher would make no positive assertions about the fundamental nature of things. But this claim must raise the nature of things very seriously. That is, Nagarjuna will be refusing to say anything about the essence, keep that word in mind, of anything exactly, because he will deny the coherence and utility of the concept of an essence. For another, it is important to see that the predications that are rejected are intended to be understood as made from the ultimate standpoint. That is, the assertions that are being denied are assertions about the final nature of phenomena that emerge from philosophical analysis. The key word is final. They are not meant to be ordinary assertions dependent upon convention. Nagarjuna would deny that it is possible to assert anything from the ultimate standpoint. Key point, if you could grasp that from the beginning. Let that soak in. Nagarjuna will deny that it is possible to assert anything from the ultimate standpoint. He will urge that all truth is relative and conventional. In fact, as we shall see, these qualifications turn out to be mutually entailing. Any questions?
Yeah, you said something, I can't even quote you, that you were comparing the conventional with something else?
The conventional and the ultimate.
That's what you spoke about before we started reading? Okay. Mm-hmm. You put it a different way now,
I understand it. Well, this will, I hope, become self-elucidating as we go along. At first, you're bound to feel that these terms are a little bit disquieting. But bear with it. Because this will bend our usual percept, concept, idea of who and what we think existence is, isn't, and so on. But each pair is significant in its... Oh, I was going to have something else, right? Would you be the next? But each pair, yeah.
Is significant in its own right. To say that whatever is dependently arisen is unceasing and unborn, to emphasize that dependent arising amounts to emptiness, and emptiness amounts to non-existence, ultimate sense. While, as we shall see, Nagarjuna sends the conventional existence of phenomena. He will urge that none of them ultimately exist, that none of them exist independently of convention, with identities and natures that they possess in themselves.
Okay, stop just a second. Again, important, really important, because over and over, and even in India today, and even in the United States today, with certain professors, certain Buddhologists make the claim that the Mula Madhyamaka, as presented by Nagarjuna, is a nihilistic doctrine. But you will read here that Nagarjuna has never said that things do not exist. He said they do not exist ultimately. They can only exist conventionally, or that we can only know them conventionally. So, what does that mean? Okay?
Therefore, he will argue nothing ultimately is born, and from the ultimate standpoint, there is nothing to see. This is a deep point, which only emerges completely through a reading of the whole text. But we can say that this point, that this insight contains is in the seed of this eventual equation. The words I'll say them, but they don't hang together. Of the phenomenal world with emptiness, of samsara with nirvana, and the conventional and the ultimate that are the hallmarks of the
Prasadika.
Say it again?
Prasadika.
Prasana.
Gita.
Gita.
The Prasadika, as I said, that's the Tibetan. So, here's the crucial point. We can say that at this point that the insight contains within it the seeds of an eventual equation between what is considered the phenomenal world or the ultimate world and the conventional world, that is the world of linguistic understanding, the world of everyday appearances and so on, are not true. This is the basic teaching of all the Madhyamaka, that nirvana is not at some other time or place, in our understanding of the here and now. It's exactly as it appears, except that until we see that there is no inherent existence in any of the phenomena arising, until we can actually see that and understand what that means, we will always reify some aspect of ourselves.
What
does
reify?
Reify means, huh? Well, reify actually means to substantiate, to make something, to rigidify, to make solid.
Like reify.
Yeah. Deify. No, reify or reify is another way of pronouncing it. Means to take an idea or a concept and turn it into a thing, an object to grasp onto, and concretize is a good word. Concretize is a very good word. That's what we're always doing, and that we're born almost doing that. Anyway, he'll explain it even better.
Yeah.
So.
I personally take it deeply. Dumb it down, would you?
Okay. Well, dumb it down is simply that normally, I mean, most religions, most approaches, even in the Buddha Dharma, in the earlier schools, and even in the Yogacara to some extent, and into the Tathagarbha, understanding that the Buddha nature is eternal and underlies all things and so on, other doctrines, is that there is nothing that you can sit, there is no way of understanding the ultimate other than as an aspect of the conventional. That it is not, that you see, basically, we have the idea that if I practice long enough and hard enough, I will drop my whole conceptual view of the world and suddenly, shazam! I understand the real world will come forward through the convention. But that is not the case, what he is saying. This is the view that we're studying. You don't have to agree with this. This is the idea that whatever we understand of the world, of phenomena, has been explained to us from the beginning as concepts. Now, in the Buddha Dharma, it is true, it is axiomatic that if we could have a pure perception of phenomena, unmediated by any ideas that we have been conditioned by, we would see reality. Since the nature of suffering is a misconstruing or a misunderstanding of the nature of reality, which is empty of any inherent existence in all of its formation. Meaning that there's nothing that can stand independently as a self apart from everything else. Not ideas, not forms, not feelings, not time itself. All things arise dialectically. And that dialectic arising, large and small, male and female and so on, are all expressions, conventional expressions. Now the only way we can understand the ultimate, what is called the ultimate, or the release of our grasping tendencies, our reifying tendencies, is through concept. Through hearing, understanding, through language itself. But until we understand that language itself is dependently co-arisen, that there's no final self that you can grasp in any concept, no finality. If we can see that from the beginning, then we understand that all things are relative. Including the concept. And as you eventually say, the concept of emptiness itself is the emptiness of emptiness. Emptiness is not a void that underlies phenomena. Emptiness is only a characteristic realized conventionally.
Through form.
Not independent of form, exactly. There's another way of saying form is emptiness and emptiness of form. Form is no other than emptiness is no other form. But now it's going to really get broken down into the very way we make emptiness, or what we think is form, into a solid, graspable entity. All right. Let's go on with the introduction. Would you go on, Jeff?
When the Nagarjuna claims that whatever is dependently arisen is annihilated and not permanent, he indicates that the dependently arisen world and all of its contents are, in virtue of being dependently arisen and dependent upon conditions, impermanent. Phenomena come into existence when the conditions upon which they depend obtain, and they cease to exist when the conditions for their continued existence no longer obtain. This impermanence, he will argue, entails their non-existence from the ultimate standpoint. For there will be no principled way to assert criteria for identities or phenomena that distinguish them in any principled way from their condition. Nor can we find any essence they themselves have that determines their identity. The criteria for identity we posit will end up being purely conventional. Hence, the same is true for any claims of substantial difference between things. But this impermanence and lack of intrinsic identity, while it amounts to impossibility of ultimate existence, is not equivalent to annihilation. The empirical reality of things on the Gardner's analysis is not denied by asserting their emptiness.
Okay. Want to read?
Finally, the search that inquiry not coming, not known, is the search of the phenomenal world of not known. Previously, I just called it inquiry, but the truth independently, research, I just control the past.
Okay, read that again. Underline that sentence in your mind. Laminate it and put it in your wallet. Read it every day.
Finally, the search that things are not coming, not going, is the search that the phenomenal world is not contained in a consistent identifiable entity, and the search independently with those identities over time.
Well, just look in the mirror from day to day. Okay.
And the consequence there can be no search between the only entry, independent and sequential, and constant search when entry existing, the meaning of this one, or the value.
See, normally we say, you know, when I was 7 years old, I... Now, who is this I? We have in the language a subject and a predicate, an actor and an action. Now, he's not denying that there's conventionally, not the, that there is not a conventional reality of a separate self from everything else that happens. He's not denying that conventionality. But he says if you begin to look for the I that you have assumed to be a real self over and against everything that happens to this self, the history that happens to it, it's just me, and that stuff has happened to me. Where is the me at any particular time that you can point to that is a self in the sense of being permanent and autonomous? In other words, exists of its own without any other conditions arising. So in the meditative techniques that are presented to particular schools, one has to learn, after one hears this teaching, to sit down and begin to examine, first of all, by focusing the mind through mindfulness techniques and shamatha on a single point. This is their way of doing it. This is not necessarily the Zen way of doing it. Until the mind becomes stabilized, and at that time, as phenomena arise in your mind during the meditative practice, you begin to analyze it to see each thing that arises. Watch it arise, thought, feeling. Watch it grow into existence. Watch it begin to dissipate. Watch it vanish. Thoughts, feelings, physical sensations, and so forth. And by doing this process over and over and over, calming the mind, as it's called, shamatha or vipassana, and analyzing the constituents of what we consider to be a self and the skandhas and so on, we cannot find anything independent of everything else. But hearing that alone is not enough. It must be practiced. So first we hear it, and then we wonder about it, and we begin to look at it in our practice. Now, anyway, that's enough. I won't say anymore. Okay, who's next? Okay. What is this? You say, it's a book. We have no trouble. That's a conditional designation. At some point in our life, even though we could feel it as children and so on, until that word book came into that. You see a book, and we impute that the book has some fundamental existence as a book. But if we try to analyze what that fundamental existence is, other than just the convention of being a book, with seed, first of all, as it's been pointed out many times in the Prajnaparamita teaching, that what we talk about a book is just a point in time, space, of the coming together of certain materials, the trees and all the things that made the book materially, all the people that brought this book together, and our own imputation book, imputed to this thing over here, but from the book's side, we can know nothing about what that book is from its side. This is, to anybody who's studied Western philosophy, and particularly not Hume, who am I thinking of? Categorical imperatives. Huh? Kant. We'll understand that we can't understand something, also can't be understood, a thing cannot be understood except by our imputations of it. From its own side, nothing whatsoever can be said about what that is, ultimately. In another sense, what we're saying is that we cannot ultimately know the existence of anything. We don't know what anything is other than our descriptions of it and our experience conventionally of those that we feature in those descriptions. That should be clear to most of us, I think, in our life, if we look at it carefully and closely. But we are constantly imputing names or signs or marks, as they might say, in other contexts, to phenomena, and then reifying or concretizing those aspects. I exist, it exists, these feelings are real. And as everything changes, we hold on to something against the field of change. That grasping or holding on to concepts and feelings that arise are charged those concepts, with which those concepts are charged, that grasping feeling, that holding on to something that cannot be held on to because it doesn't fundamentally exist, is, of course, basically the cause of suffering. But Nagarjuna is going to try to point out, as we now go into the Four Noble Truths, is that if we think that something called Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the Four Noble Truths and the teaching of the Buddha, that we have, if we reify those concepts, we're missing the point of Buddhism. I think Suzuki Roshi once said, Buddhism, he didn't say that Buddhism is the one religion that deconstructs itself, he didn't use that word, but he said that, at least as I remember reading in transcript, something like this. He said, the Judaic religion no longer postulates a God, or Christianity a Christ and holds on to that, or Buddhism holds on to Buddha, that's Buddhism. And we release the grasping tenets. When we give up, when we see through that the tenets of the religion themselves are simply conventional nominal designations, when we understand that point clearly, then we begin to really appreciate the fact that these descriptions of reality must be left behind. That's the Prajnaparamita. That's the boat that carries us across, is the understanding through description of what ordinary reality seems to be. And that those words themselves, because they are dependently co-arisen among us, have no substantial self to them. Ultimate self. Except conventionally. And you know it perfectly well conventionally. The thing that this is a device. This is a way to free. This is skillful means that Nagarjuna was presenting. Don't reify emptiness. Don't make emptiness into something. Don't make this into another philosophy. Try to see this teaching as a way of loosening our grip on the way we grasp, the way we reify, the way we project, the way we impute. And that I that it's imputing is also an imputation. Mm-hmm, Okay, now please turn to anything else we need to. This was just to kind of give you a taste of what we're getting into.
293.
Yes, chapter 24. I bring up this chapter, and it's really important eventually to go back to the beginning. But from chapter 24 on, Nagarjuna really begins to articulate the two truths, the conventional and the ultimate, and show how they are one, and not exactly the same, and not exactly different. If they were exactly the same, then we wouldn't have to practice anything. And if they were totally different, then there would no be a way to practice at all, because you couldn't reach the ultimate. There would be no way, since we live in a conventional world. If the ultimate is exactly the same as the conventional, then exactly the way we are is already the truth. But we're all suffering some kind of anxiety, some kind of existential angst, some kind of uptightness. The feeling separates us from everything else. Or we feel the separation, exactly. That's the pain that Buddha's talking about. But if we were totally different, if the ultimate was something other than conventional, there's no way we could reach it, since language and the modalities or the status of our life as conventional would not be able to, there would not be any way to reach an ultimate truth. So they're not exactly the same, and they're not exactly different.
It reminds me of our Garden saying that you get enlightened through delusion.
Yeah.
No other way.
That's right. Delusion is. Those who are enlightened about delusion. Those who are deluded are greatly deluded about enlightenment. Whatever, and what, you know, what he said, that to study the self is to forget yourself, in the sense that all phenomena comes forward to verify who you are from moment to moment. Another way of saying it is, when I look for me, all I can find is you. That, it. From the air I breathe, to the sun that illuminates, to the ideas that I've grasped, to whatever getting out, all came seemingly from out there, from that side. And I look for this side. And we're doing the same right now. Right now, we're telling each other stories. The story is, there's such a thing called the Buddha Dharma, and there's this historical moment in the Buddha Dharma, and we broaden our understanding, we broaden our conceptual base of what life is as a conventional mode of operation. And then as we do that, the story is, watch yourself do that. That's what we're always doing. We're always broadening a new perspective. We're always acculturating a new way of, through acculturation, a new way of seeing. Until we actually, in some ways, stop and say, I don't want to know anymore. Not be through that. I've had it. I'm satisfied. That's the animal realm. I'm satisfied. I don't want to know anymore. But you can't help it no more. Because there's no you to grasp onto, holding onto what you think you can hang on to. Anyway. Examination of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, let's go on. What time is it? Okay, so what I'm proposing is that we'll go slow through this, and it should take us 3 weeks to get through this chapter. So you can go back and forth over each point. We will go through the verses. Yeah, we'll start the verses with this. But he gives the commentary, and to see the arrangement of the way the verses are laid out, first with the opponent's objection to what he's saying, which is a natural way to be, what are you talking about? There's only conventional reality. So, who's the next reader, please? It begins with
chapter 24, ostensibly concerning the four Buddhist truths and the way they are to be understood.
Now this is Nagarjuna's main point, because what the opponent is going to say is that this is what you are saying would make understanding impossible and is nihilistic. But what Nagarjuna will show with his wonderful dialectical reasoning is that in fact, if things were not empty, nothing could be understood. No realization would be possible. There couldn't be a Four Noble Truth. And he will present his reasons why he understands that to be so. I'm not going to try to cap either Garfield or Nagarjuna way of presenting that. Okay, please go on. The tactic.
This tactic of arguing not only against these extremes, but of arguing with the contradictory extremes.
Can I ask to read it again?
Now remember, this is the person refuting Nagarjuna. All of these verses are saying that if you're saying that nothing arises and has inherent existence and so on, then there can't be the Four Noble Truths. If there's not the Four Noble Truths, then there can't be, you know, the Dharma. If there's not the Dharma, there can't be the practitioners. Then there can't be the salvation and so forth.
This is also
the commentary. The commentary is just
commenting
on what the reputation is saying. He's just paraphrasing. He's just
okay.
All that Garfield does now is explain the verse, explicate the verse. He says it so that those
clarifying what the verse.
It's not so hard for us, but people who've never heard of the Four Noble Truths and so on are reading this as a philosophical doctrine. He needs to, you know, kind of explain this to them. But it's flesh it out. Yeah, it's really important that, and I like what Garfield does. He really wants you to see the natural way that one would first hear this, and why the Indian mind, particularly the Vedantists and so on, would say that this, and to this day, this is a nihilistic doctrine, and why. Well, this is the Indian way. Yeah, what Nagarjuna does, what Nagarjuna started out by saying, and I'll mention the text, he says, we understand that a thing is either produced by itself, by something else, by both the self and something else, or by neither self or them. And then he refutes logically how any of those can happen. That's the first chapter. None of that can actually be shown to have ultimate existence. We won't go into the logic of that at the moment. But that is the Indian way of logically working with epistemology and ontology and the basis of life and how we understand it. To make the four assertions. A thing is, a thing isn't, a thing both is and isn't, a thing neither is and isn't. Now what is it? So he, and there were many schools at that time, realist schools, nihilist schools, faith schools, devotional schools, and so on, that whose position, each of which had a position in one of those. A thing exists, a thing doesn't exist, those were the nihilists, the skeptics. A thing both exists and doesn't, that was another school. And so what we're actually getting here is an old format, or formula for debating or dialectical understanding with the rules of grammar and the rules of debating positions in the Indian, way, in the ancient way. So he's simply reiterating this pattern and explaining it, he being Garfield in this case.
So, the structure
of, in this case, the structure, it's not this case in all the format, but in this case, the verses start with the opponent's objection to what was said in the previous chapter. And then what the next step will be, Nagarjuna will listen to the opponent's objection and then take his argument and show why logically it is absurd. It cannot be said to be ultimate. He will show logically. This is
in the same chapter.
Yes. This will happen in the same chapter. That's why I picked out this particular chapter, because this is the typical chapter format of all of the book, and it brings it, what has been said before, to a climax and begins to really bring together all the arguments that were earlier presented. No, but you would never know. That's what I said, why you would have to have a commentary. You would know by reading the verses who's saying what to whom. Well, you won't say this is not ignorant, but you would have to be able to read the original and know the whole argument from the beginning. Then you would begin. you'd have to be familiar with the methodology and the layout of the argument, of the method of which the argument is presented. And Garfield is doing that for us, and he's taken that from Chandrakirti and earlier. Many people, gosh, it's 9 o'clock, boys. Well, we just began, and we're at 9 o'clock, so what do you want to do? I mean, this is, if you take this home and practice with it, read it over and over, and start reading this book, I guarantee you, you won't be able to, I mean, it'll nag at you. And you'll get actually annoyed and irritated with it. No. The whole point of the Madhyamaka teaching, Dharma Juna is not interested in just overturning other philosophies. This has a soteriological or a self-ethic or however you want to put it. It's a way to help us understand why we suffer. But it's done through the elucidation of logic and reasoning, which in this tradition, at least the Madhyamaka tradition, is the first step. That there's no way we're going to intuit this. We're going to actually have to sit down and hear it and logically figure it out. And that's the way the human mind works. And once we convince ourselves that the argument might have some merit, then we can begin to meditate and practice with it. And everything that comes up, every time we feel this contraction called me and the suffering, we begin to look for what is this I that is suffering? What is the nature of the suffering? A good way to practice it is, next time you have something that makes you suffering, you say, I'm going to feel this for the next 24 hours, or even the next 24 minutes. A mystical experience can only be understood conventionally. I mean, you could have it, what you call it, but the way you would present it was, I'm having an experience and I can't put it into words. And then you just put it into words. Yeah. Well, but that spontaneous, as soon as that happens, immediately the mind will take hold of it, that is to say the mind of the conventional way of understanding something, which is linguistic, which is nominal, and put it into words. And the words will be, I can't tell you, I can't really explain this feeling, but it's like...
Well, but the words would be like a map, and the map itself doesn't represent the process.
Well, there's a central argument. That you cannot know the map until you've got the words. That you will not know that until it comes in the what Chandrakirti, the argument is that there's no, you cannot have a pure perception until you say, I've had a pure perception, until you logically form it into language. Language is not labels put onto experience. Language arises with experience. You can have an experience without language, but the first moment of the experience can be something. But the next moment, it cannot be articulated even to yourself until there's some way to grasp it. And the way you will grasp it is conventional. It always occurs within convention. That's what he's saying. You can have other experiences and so on, but they will never occur outside of what is called the conventional world. Well, you will be using conventional terms to try to prove it. That's what we're always doing. We're always telling each other, and if you look to substantiate that experience as having some ultimate meaning, you will see that as soon as you try to substantiate it, it's gone. You can't find it anywhere. So enlightenment is not a question of having some experience. It might be an experience. Enlightenment is a question of a release from the grasping at experience itself, what high or low, left or right, up or down, opening to it as it is. And that is, you know, we'll get back to Zen, we'll get back to Dogen, we'll get back to the fact that the experiences of the here and now that are arising as suchness, seeing the emptiness at the same time as the conventional aspect in which it is the modality or the status of the experience itself is always conventional. Ah, but I always thought it was something underneath I could finally get hold of if only I would get rid of my conventional mind.
Right, right. The understanding.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And so, therefore, there is a change in the experience.
Yes. Of course, there's change in the experience. That's what he's saying. You can't. The experience is not. Don't reify the experience as being an independent entity from everything else. That arose because of certain causes and conditions, which, when they change, that experience will evaporate. That's why people come down from their highs. They go up, and they can even go through all the jhanas and get into neither perception or non-perception and sit there without anything happening at all, like Ramakrishna and some of these great yogis did. But when they come down, as Buddha found, when he came down, he was back in the world of relativity. He wasn't satisfied. Now, they say that arhats can reach the place where there's no grasping after concept anymore. It simply means that they understand that the concept no longer has any hold on you because there's no you anymore reified to have a hold on it. That doesn't mean, however, that the world of ordinary appearances, as we understand it, suddenly evaporates through logic, through understanding. There are other ways. There will be other ways. In fact, the Dogzhan school, Dzogchen school, is much closer to what we would call Shikantaza, is that bare awareness or the illumination of consciousness is already always the case, and you don't have to do anything. But just open to it and be it. Except we don't do that. See, what he's going to show you over and over is that what we call the conventional world, we do not treat as conventional. We treat as absolute. That's the big jump. Once we begin to understand that the conventional world is just conventional, merely conventional, and that merely conventional, once it is understood as ultimately nothing else than being put together, and including my understanding of it, of causes and conditions, then maybe we can get a little relaxation. But it has to be practiced. Anyway, that's how I understand it. This is my interpretation of him to you. This is my story to you. You will now hear it. Incorporate it into your understanding, broaden it in your way, in your interpretation, and we pass it back and forth. We're storytelling, human beings are storytellers. We use language to understand our world by. But is there a world apart from it? Yes, he's not denying that there is phenomena. There's some quantum swarm out there that the bee sees differently than you see it, a snake understands differently, that a lizard understands differently, that our minds put together in a certain way. And all of this epistemology about that and so on is a method of seeing how we do that. And then once I hear that story, I say, I'm going to project that and see how that is. In other words, I'm going to try to experience that. And as soon as I think I got some experience, I'm going to hold on to that experience. And I'll find out, what about the guy that yesterday thought it was this way? That guy's gone, now I got this understanding. Who am I? You can't find it. You can't find yourself. So we get back to Zen this way. You see, when people no longer, when they begin to understand that you can memorize all the sutras in the world from end to end, and know Buddhist doctrine and dogma upside down and be eloquent. If somebody comes in the room and goes, "Ah!" You jump out of your skin. So, now it's the time, I guess. Whatever you guys do now, how does this work? Is this okay? I mean, is this what we want to do?
However you want to do it, however you feel it, it works best for you. Norman will usually read the text, and then he might pose a question that he will break his plan to do it, and do it to talk about, and then we'll come back with the other one.
I don't know if we have enough material tonight for you to see if you can do that, but by next week, take this book with you and read the chapter a couple of times. Go back and read his introduction to the chapter. I would say if I would read the whole chapter. Yeah, and then I would go back and read his before. Yeah, back to page 87. Introduction to the commentary. I think go into that. He says it is not self-existing, void standing behind a veil of illusion comprising conventional reality, but merely a characteristic of conventional reality. I mean, I underlined a lot of things even in that commentary when I was reading it. That it was very helpful. But I... And, yes. And you can read the dedicatory thing again. But when you see this little verse down here, memorize it. It's verse 18, Karika 18, and I'll read it to you. Well, I'm just doing it in the introduction, but you will also find it. 93 or in the... Anyway, 18, Karika 18, page 93 in the introduction. Whatever is dependently co-arisen is explained to be emptiness. That, being a dependent designation, is itself the middle way. This is the most famous of all of the Karikas, and is something that every Madhyamaka student, at least in the old days, memorized. Whatever is dependently co-arisen, which is everything, is said to be emptiness. Okay? Because it's dependently co-arisen. That nominal thing I just said, being a dependent designation, the way I just explained it, is itself the middle way. Take that verse, ponder it this week and next week. At the end of our reading, we can break into groups and discuss it. You can. A verbal convention. To depend on designation. You need it for, hey, the Sharingan Sutra is all epistemology.
Chinese. Down your brain?
Yeah.
Below your brain.
See, basically, the verse is so powerful, this and say that simple language.
Yes.
And this is a noble.
Yes, exactly. What I just said was a conventional way of describing something. Once you understand that that is empty itself, you understand that that's the middle way.
Well,
so when that. Well, they didn't have that in those days. That is the middle way. If you can. That was what Buddha could do, they say. Most of us, if you can see, as you have to hold the paradox, so you know, that seeing of the wine glass becomes the two faces, and then the wine glass is really, you can't see, you can see one and then the other, and then the one. Some people can see both. In some sense, and begin to actually, it goes so fast that you can actually begin, and by practice they say, we can begin to actually do that between the conventional and the ultimate. Since the ultimate is not anything else but a description of the bitten origination. Yeah. Okay? Yes.
About my opinion, if he can't come to this intuitively, then you have to be led through this logical process. Was he working with the doctor just now?
I think so. You know, well, see, this is very Indian. I mean, the Indian mind is philosophical and analytical. The Chinese mind, you know, it's very analytical. And the philosophies, particularly, I think the philosophy of the Middle Way, personally, I think is the subtlest religious doctrine of anything I've ever read. Because it gives you nothing to hold on to but what you already are. And then you don't hold on to that anymore because you can see that it shows you something. And it comes simply through the reason. But it works with your intuition because in some sense we know that already.
Well,
but if we... Yeah, I don't know. We don't know anything about him. We don't know anything about him, other than he was apparently, there are two Nagarjunas actually, but apparently he was a gifted, we know that he wrote the Buddha Madhyamaka and a couple of other doctrines, some sanghas and so on, but not much else is known about him.
Except he disrupted the whole...
Well, that was just a legend, I mean, that came up to... The what? Yeah, and also this idea of going deep, and that the subtlety of this teaching, which was that in the earlier Buddha Dharma we needed something like the Abhidharma to give us an atomist idea of the universe that was made up of discrete entities, even though those entities were impermanent, they come together as irreducible elements to make a self, the five skandhas, for example. But by the time we got to the middle way was saying, wait a minute, you can't say that there's even constituents that make up a self, like skandhas and so on. Those are just conventional designations that we have made up. Everything is empty of any self. But that's, you see, most people are not satisfied with that, because we have a need to hang on to something, some underpinning, some substrat in our life. So that's why the Tathagata Garbha, I think, the doctrine of the womb of the Tathagata, that there could be no enlightenment without that already being in place in our life as consciousness, as the radiant oneness of self and other, that is a permanent, indestructible phenomenon. And Nagarjuna would say, well, I want to be positive. That's a conventional designation. If you want to believe that, that's fine. I don't have any objection to that. It makes me feel happy. Just understand that, and then he could, you know, say, prove that whatever, however you try to reify it or prove that, he would show you the absurdity of your life, of your logic, other than conventional. In other words, you can have all the metaphysical ideas you want and present them in the context of the conventional, but you can't prove it. Other than conventional. You just say, I had this experience that I was floating on the cloud, and that there's nothing here but a dream, or something like that. We do now. Anyway, I'm getting hoarse. Do we close with anything? No. Beings are numberless. Beings are numberless. I vow illusions are inexhaustible. I vow kingdom. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. Incidentally, I didn't read this book until today, and I read most of it, but I really like some of the things that Stephen Batchelor says. There are a couple of things that he and Garfield do not agree on, and incidentally, there's numerous footnotes in here talking about Huntington and others who have commented on this. And what is interesting in all of this is that there's not unanimity about what all of this means, even among the scholars and Buddhologists, nor has it been in the different traditions in Tibet or other schools of the Madhyamaka. So, what is the truth? Constantly.